For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out tonight. Good to see you all. My name is Matt Vogel. I'm the Eno here at Ancient Dragon. And I'll just get started. So I don't know if you've ever felt this way, but lately I've been feeling really stuck. Maybe not so much in my job. I just started a new job, so it's been very lively. But when I get home, you know, I just feel like I'm just kind of stuck. And like, I'm like, oh, I'm going to go read some books. But every time I look at a book, I'm like, none of this sounds good. I try to read something. It's like, this is boring. I don't know. Like, I just can't get into anything. So I'm like, okay, I'll watch some TV. Nothing. Like, I go through Netflix, and I'm just like, nope. And just all over, I'm just feeling a little bit like, I'm like stuck. I don't know where I'm going a little bit, you know. Maybe I need a change. I don't know. So over the summer, I went to a week-long sesshin at Hokyoji. It's a retreat center in southeastern Minnesota. And at the end of it, we had this like circle where we broke the silence and everyone had a chance to share what some impression or whatever they were thinking at that moment. And the rule was to trust emergence. Trust emergence. So to trust whatever was arising at that moment, that what was arising was supposed to be there and was actually something very special. Some causes and conditions created that to arise at that moment. And so I've kind of held on to that since August, like this trust emergence as sort of like my motto or my mantra a little bit, and just try to transfer that not only into Zazen, but also into my everyday life. And so when this stuck feeling is rising up, I decided to just trust it and not try to fix it. Usually I might go for, you know, like long, well, I still went for long walks, but I might try to fix it in some way, like make it go away. So instead I just like sat with it and I just took that backward step and let that feeling arise in my body. I'm not trying to figure out. Also, I usually like, oh, so why am I feeling like this way? Maybe I need to do this. Maybe I need to make this change. So I just kind of been sitting with this in my everyday life. And kind of what is interesting to me is just this like feeling, this stuck feeling has really helped me settle in a way and helped me to reconnect with vow, with that sort of deep intention that sort of helps push and propel my life. So I'm going to talk a little bit about vow, my very limited understanding of that, and specifically kind of revolving a little bit around the four bodhisattva vows, but this could be for any vow too. So what is a vow? So I looked up some definitions, and, you know, it's like a solemn promise. It's a personal commitment, something that you do to attain something. And the bodhisattva vows, I don't think, are these kinds of promises or commitments. Maybe, or something to attain, probably not. Maybe sometime, I don't know. So the vows that we say here are, beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. And Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. And some people translate as, I vow to embody it. So I like that kind of flavor to it too. So something to attain. I mean, the first part of it, beings are numberless. I vow to free them. That seems contradictory and impossible. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. So the first and second part of these vows seem totally not to make sense at all. And the first time I ever recited these vows was in California. I went to a Zen group led by Catherine Thanis, who I think she was a student of Suzuki Roshi, I think. Direct, yeah. So she studied with Suzuki Roshi. It was the Monterey Bay Zen Center. It was 1996, I think. And so when I recited these vows, I had two sort of like reactions to them. First, coming from like I was raised as a very, as a Christian, and like saying a vow was like something really serious. You know, if I'm vowing this is like probably going to make me go to hell, maybe. I don't know, like, you know. But on the other hand, it was like, oh, what's going to, no big deal. I'm just going to say it and who cares. As I was like thinking about this trust emergence, those saying those vows and sitting Zazen at Monterey Bay Zen Center, it really propelled and changed my life. And of course, my life would have changed anyway. But I think that those vows that I've said them probably nearly every day since then, have really informed and like pushed my life. Or I'm going to talk a little bit more about this feeling that I'm doing, and I'm making this gesture right now. Like, there's something about it that it's really inexplicable, and not, I don't really understand it, but there's something that about how they have informed and changed me. And I think at the heart of these is that, of these vows, is that as bodhisattvas, and bodhisattvas are awakening beings, in contrast to maybe awakened beings, like Buddhas, bodhisattvas are beings that are still awakening, still on this path, and they have vowed to not attain enlightenment until everyone else has. So they're letting everyone else go in front of them before they do. And usually there are these sort of big figures like Manjushri on the altar, Jizo Bodhisattva, Kanzeon. So these big kind of mythic archetypal figures. If you want to read a great book about it, there's this guy named Taigen Dan Leighton who wrote, I read it as Bodhisattva Archetypes, but what's the Faces of Compassion? Have you heard that before?
I read it once.
Read it once, yeah, okay. Yeah. So, So that actually like is a great book to like get this sort of archetypal, like these big, but we also understand it in our lineage as we are bodhisattvas, and anyone who is helping other beings is a bodhisattva. And these vows help us really to remember we're really trying to benefit others. We're trying to be kind to others, including ourselves. Norman Fisher recently wrote a book called The World Could Be Otherwise, and he talks about these big vows. And he says, the unimaginative mind is very careful about vows. One should only vow what one feels one can realistically accomplish in a doable time frame. It sounds like what we call SMART goals or something like that. It's like specific, measurable, yeah, all that. These aren't SMART goals. Otherwise, one will have welched on one's promise. While this makes sense in the small-scale version of our lives, it's far too limiting for the outrageously expansive life of a bodhisattva. I like that. Outrageously expansive life of a bodhisattva. For bodhisattvas, a vow is not the same as a promise to accomplish something, so that you can then go on to accomplish something else. Rather, a vow is expressive of deep intention and vision, a horizon toward which you will journey forever. We can't make or take vows like this. We can only practice them. To practice a vow means to embrace it in a heartfelt way, heartfelt and serious way. Though we know that, as we are now, our commitment can't possibly run very deep. So I like this sort of like outrageously expansive, and like this idea of that And it's really helped me understand, like, it's about practicing them. It's not trying to attain something. Shohaku Okamura wrote about these vows as well, and the four bodhisattva vows, and he says, facing the infinite or absolute, we are really nothing. No matter how long we practice zazen, we cannot be proud of what we have accomplished. So if we think about infinite past, infinite, like, everything we do, it's like, it doesn't matter. In a way. Well, we can't be proud of it anyway. At the same time, we don't need to feel guilty or inadequate because we cannot practice enough or because we cannot help others so much. No matter how small or great our accomplishments, they are all the same compared to the infinite. The important point is that even if it's only a small thing, we just do it. We don't need a fancy way to attain perfect enlightenment or a means to help all living beings. Just sit a little more or help others a little more. We should be down to earth. This is our practice. I'm going to do a little drawing right now. And I'm not like an artist or anything. I'm going to draw something that I saw in a book that was, really helped me, from Jan Chozenbe's. She is a teacher in Oregon. Her monastery is actually called Great Vow. And she talks about Jizo Bodhisattva in terms of like a pilgrimage. And so she writes, so here's a person and here's like their normal sort of like trajectory. Here's sort of like what they would do. The normal conditions they follow. Okay, you get that. So she says, even if you make a 5-degree angle change, like just one little step, it looks small right there, right? If this person makes a small step this way, with a small little change, just a little tiny change, what that ends up being is a huge difference in where they end up. So even a small change, this right here, can have a huge result or a huge difference later on. And she didn't say this, but what I like about this too is this small change, it really opens up the possibilities of how this person can now respond in many different situations. And so, I don't know, I kind of like this idea that, like Shohaku Okamura was saying, really, it doesn't... the small changes we make don't seem very big, and they're not really big compared to the infinite, but it still can make a big difference in the life of this person right here. Like me, like I was talking about. So these vows, this kind of big thing, sometimes I have a hard time understanding that. And so I was thinking about ways that I could make them real for myself, and so I'm going to share some with you, and I might be stretching some of them. I don't know. You can be the judge of that. So, when I was a teenager, I grew up in Oregon, and in the summer, my friends and I used to go down to a river. And so, this river came from Mount Hood, which is a dormant volcano. Actually, the glacier's there, and thousands of years ago, Mount Hood erupted and formed these like lava flows, and all these rocks are like fused together, and they look kind of like dinosaurs, if you like. And so they're kind of like narrow rivers, but they run really fast. And so in that summer, we'd go there and we'd like hop, jump in the river, and basically just float, and it would just carry us down. And we also, there was a cliff that we used to jump off too. That was a lot of fun. Like, and that was like 15 feet or so. It seemed like it was 1,500 feet when you're at the top of it. But you run and you jump and you like, and you plunge under the water and you come up and it's like kind of green under the water, and then you come up and you see the sun again, and you just kind of like float down a little bit until you get to like this little part, and then you come back and do it again. And so, what I was trying to explain with this earlier, this sort of, for me, like, when I was trusting emergence and was thinking about what do these vows mean to me, it's like, it's not something I understand here. It's something more that I feel here. it's like a, like that, like being in a river. I don't know if you've ever done that before, but there's like this, there's a pull, and it just takes you. And if you're float, if you're like floating, or even if you're not, it's just going to take you. There, you can't control it. You can kind of swim out of it if you need to, or move around. And sometimes rivers are too strong to do that, and people drown. But like, they're powerful, but it also supports you. It also carries you along. And that's sort of like that pull where you feel your, where I feel myself moving, and that's kind of the feeling I have about these vows. Also, I was the other day, I was walking by the lake too at night, and there was a full moon, and it was not the day when it was super windy, but I was looking up at the moon, and there were these clouds just like racing by, and I was just standing there watching them. I was like, that's kind of what it's like too. It's kind of like this invisible force that's just like pushing, and not in a, and for the clouds, it's not a holding back. It's just, they just float right in there. They follow that wind, and they just keep moving, and there's no resistance. That's what it's like for me sometimes. Other times, I'm a biker, and so I bike year-round in the winter, and all. And so sometimes the wind is really wonderful because it's this nice deep, and it, like, I barely have to pedal, and it's like just floating down. Sometimes it's like that. I think the vow just kind of, that deep intention just kind of helps push me forward. On the other hand, when I go the other way to go home, it's the opposite. It's this headwind that's pushing against me. And at first I was thinking like, oh, that's when things aren't working well. But sometimes I think also this vow works and helps helps me see like, maybe you're not going in the right way. Or maybe you need to like rethink this. Or maybe this is just life as it is right now. And you just like stick with it. And that's the way things are. Another image I came up with, and this is not my own, I don't know who came up with this, is of a vast ocean. I lived, like I said, in California, and I used to go out to the, I tried to go out to the ocean every day because I knew there's no way we're going to be able to afford to live there. And so it's like, I'm gonna go out and I'm going to take a walk by the ocean every single day. And the ocean is this like vast, almost, I think I can conceptualize it, but it's really inconceivably deep for me and really inconceivably vast. And it's like full of life and dynamic and moving and dangerous. And, you know, you have to know what it's, how to handle it. Sometimes samsara, the cycle of existence, of suffering, is described or compared to an ocean with, again, vast and teeming, and every wave is like suffering arising. But if that's the case, then that ocean of suffering is also an ocean of response. Because bodhisattva activity is everywhere. And whenever suffering arises, there's bodhisattva activity to help meet that. We don't always see it. We don't always understand it. But I feel it, that there is, no matter what it is, bodhisattvas come to help. When I just think about how I got here today, I kind of think, oh, I rode my bike here to get here. Well, someone had to make those tires. The frame I have was forged, came from somewhere in the earth. The earth made that frame, and then someone had to forge it. The roads that I was on, someone had to build those, and all the beings that had to be involved to make that rock happen to get there, and the cement. The street lights, someone had to put those in. Someone had to teach everyone how to drive. Someone had to, and then, well, someone taught someone else a long time ago to drive, and they taught us then. The food I ate before I got here, that was, you know, innumerable beings, insects, animals, had to come together to create those so that I could eat, so I could get here. So really, I think I came here, but I think actually all of these beings helped me get here. I was a little part of that, maybe, but innumerable beings are the ones who helped me to get here. So the ocean of samsara might be vast and deep, but so is the response to that suffering. Another thing I was thinking, another way of thinking, imagining this vow is of the earth. We live on this rock, right, that's spinning around, and because it's spinning around, there's gravity, so it's pulling us. So it's kind of like that vow can be like that pull of gravity. It's like constantly keeping us balanced, keeping us here, keeping us grounded. And it connects us to this planet. It connects us to each other. And the earth is deep. It's dark. It's like secret. You know, we can't really see into it. And also deep down in the earth are these treasures that we don't know about, that we can't see. But they're there. In addition, there's on this rock, there's this very thin layer of amazing, abundant life that's attached to this rock. And it's almost unfathomable, the complexity that is there. And I think that's kind of like also what the vow is like. It's complex. It's adaptable. It changes. In the Lotus Sutra, there's a chapter where the Buddha has like innumerable Buddhas from all over the different universes coming to listen to talk to him. I'm kind of paraphrasing, summarizing. And they say, like, we want to stay here to help you teach. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. I have all these other bodhisattvas to help me. And they're like, well, where are they? And all of a sudden, in the middle, there's like this huge chasm that erupts. And another millions and billions of Buddhas come out of there from the earth. And he's like, they have always been here to help me teach. And I think they have always been here to help relieve suffering and help and respond to suffering, to respond to, again, this ocean of samsara. So I think that coming from the earth in this story is like, sometimes I feel that. I don't know. I can feel that support sometimes when I'm, if you, like sitting, for example, like dropping down, just like dropping my awareness down a little bit. I don't know. I feel something pushing back up maybe a little bit. I don't know. Or walking along the lake. If I slow down enough, I don't know, there's like this support I feel. And I don't know if it's bodhisattvas supporting me, but I kind of like to think it is, you know? And to finish the elements, because I think that I also thought as I was writing this, and this didn't occur to me until I was done, it's like, oh, these are about elements like fire, wind, water, air, earth. Like, it's very elemental. These vows are elemental. There's something deeper, like not something we understand, but something we feel in our bones. Like, so fire is something that spontaneously arises, and it's there. And I think that's kind of what sometimes these vows are like in response to suffering in the world. It's there, ready to go. Fire also can be consuming, can be like this passion. Like, I think that's what bodhisattvas like us feel, this passion for helping others, for benefiting others, for entering those Dharma gates. In healthy ecosystems, fire can be a cleansing, something cleansing that helps restore the forest. The Buddha has a sermon called the Fire Sermon where he says everything is on fire. And he's talking metaphorically, I think, about eyes. And unfortunately, our planet right now, everything is on fire, it seems like. So I'm using this one a little bit more lightly because it's a little difficult for me right now to think about that. But fire has its, like, again, spontaneous quality of, it can be cleansing. It's like, moves us forward. So where do these vows come from? I think the other part of that has carried with me since California is Zazen. And I think I've also been sitting Zazen, maybe not every single day, but fairly consistently since that time. And I think when we sit in this upright and relaxed posture, and we are fully in touch and engaging with whatever's arising in our experience, so with our senses, with our emotions, our feelings, whatever is arising, when we get in touch with those particulars, somehow we are able to get in touch also with something deeper that, or maybe not deeper. It's hard for me to talk about this. But something that's immediate and something that's intimate, that I think that's where where I get in touch with that vow. And it's not something necessarily that I sit down and think, oh, let me get in touch with my vow right now. It's like, it's just sitting there and it just kind of comes up. That pull that I felt that I was describing. Blanche Hartman wrote an article called Living a Life of Vow, and she says, it's online, it's really good, you should read it, just to welcome your life as it arrives moment after moment, to meet it as fully as you can, being as open to it as you can, being as ready for whatever arises as you can, and meeting it wholeheartedly. This is renunciation. Now, usually I think of renunciation as something that I don't want to do. It's something like I have to give up something that I really like to do. But she's not talking, I mean, that could be, but I don't think that's not what she's really talking about. I recently heard Bill Fronsdahl, he gave a talk about renunciation. He said sometimes the word renunciation means going forth in Pali. So I like that, actually. Renunciation is something, instead of like giving up stuff, it's like you're actually going forth. And she says, this is renunciation. This is leaving behind all of your preferences, all of your ideas and notions and schemes, just meeting life as it is. And I think that's that's what Zazen is about, is sitting and being ready for whatever arises, being open to whatever arises as we can, meeting it wholeheartedly, trusting emergence. And I think when we are able to just do this in this really simple way, that's when these vows arise. Shohaku Okamura also says, he had that thing about the infinite and absolute, but he says, the four bodhisattva vows are an essential point, not just in our practice of Zazen, but also in our day-to-day lives. Each of us has a job or a family, and in each situation, we try to practice the Four Noble Truths and the Four Bodhisattva Vows. Our practice is the whole of life, not something special that we do in the monastery, or at Sesshin, or at retreat. Those are important parts of our practice. But the Buddha taught us to awaken to the reality of our lives on the basis of that reality. We have to live right now, right here, with this body in mind, and in the company of others. The guiding force, the compass that leads us to live out this reality, is the Bodhisattva vows. For some reason, that really like, going from the Norman Fisher, this outrageously expansive, these big vows, it's really about just like settling. It's also about settling into this body, into our lives, with each other, with the people we live with, all the beings around us that help support us. And it doesn't have to be this special thing. Although I think when we truly are just doing what we're doing, just sitting, or just cutting vegetables, or just typing on the computer. That's miraculous. That's kind of marvelous when you can just do that. I don't know. I'm just going to end with a poem, or part of a poem. It's called All the True Vows by David White. I don't really know that much about David White. I think he's a British poet. Anyway, I'm going to read a little bit of it. All the true vows are secret vows. The ones we speak out loud are the ones we break. I certainly have broken the Bodhisattva vows many times. I've said them out loud many times. I like this. All the true vows are secret vows. That word secret, I don't know, it's like... they're hidden. We know them. Maybe other people don't. Or maybe we can whisper them to other people. In Zen, we have this expression that sometimes not knowing is most intimate, and sometimes not knowing is secret. This idea of like, so I'm thinking of secret as like being intimate. So all the true vows are intimate vows. There's only one life you can call your own, and 1,000 others you can call by any name you want. Hold to the truth you make every day with your own body. Don't turn your face away. Hold to the truth you make every day with your own body. That reminds me of like that part of Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. How can we embody this truth? And don't turn your face away. Reminds me a little bit of that. Turning away and touching are both wrong. It's like something we can't, like the secret vow thing, we can't like, ooh, it's like something we can't pin down. Hold to your own truth at the center of the image you were born with. Or maybe the image that you were born with before your parents were born, I don't know. Those who do not understand their destiny will never understand the friends they have made, nor the work they have chosen, nor the one life that waits beyond all the others. That life that waits beyond all the others. What is that? And maybe it's not beyond all the others. Maybe it's right here and we just have to settle into it. Maybe it's like this life right here that's all inside of here. Not necessarily a straight line. I don't believe in straight lines really, but like, you know, it's very curvy. That's the true life. That's... thank you for listening. I'm glad I trusted Emergence because I had a different talk in mind. And I don't know, it was one that I gave at Hyde Park about the four Bodhisattva vows, which was, I enjoyed that one, but this one just arose last night, and I was like, I'm going to do this last night. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Matt. All those questions,
arguments.
Matt, thank you so much. That was so deeply personal. I'm really impressed as I'm getting to know you better.
Oh, thank that you.
It was meaningful to me, and it spoke to some things that I've been thinking about, struggling emotionally, intellectually, personally. I really needed to hear. This was great. Thank you so much. Just one thing that occurred to me into your talk was your constant, and I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but kind of the constant illusion of things in circularity coming around, things coming around again, and you start at a certain place, talked about things that propel the gym. Mm-hmm. Of course, generally means you're going from point A to A to mm-hmm. point B, and then at the end of that one, your trajectory can stop. But I obviously, it's not how you feel. Mm-hmm. It's the best and perhaps only way that you can start the conversation about what actually is a process of eternally returning again and again to the same situation, feeling, circumstance, vow, you know, and your bicycle trip, you know, away from home to your destination, with the wind behind you, you turn around, you return, and you finally really need to affirm both the wind at your back and the wind at your face. You know, the rebirth that comes from the cycles of the earth, you know, the moon, you alluded to, it's, you know, it's a spherical shape, the circles of the planets, including the earth, the seasons, you know, and it's really charming. And you mentioned about your boy, the river, you know, in Oregon, and, you know, that you jump in, allow yourself to be carried away, and manage to get out somehow, and come back around, and just joyfully, aimlessly do it again. You know, and the whole time, you're just affirming this. And I was thinking about my daughter, who is 17, and she and her mother are having a terrible time. Her mother and I are in the midst of a divorce. And so I've taken her in as of the last week, in complete violation of my lease. So nobody's saying that. It's interesting. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But she's very depressed about this. You know, I mean, I'm concerned about her emotions. And I don't have Wi-Fi in my apartment because I can't afford it. Not that I really want it anyway. But if I had the money, I'd buy it for her. So, but I don't have the money. And so she has to, like, actually live a Wi-Fi free life. It's really torment for an adolescent.
Oh, yeah.
And so one day she comes back from high school. She's got a couple of gigantic books in her room, and they're myths and folk tales. And I shoot them down, and I just said, what they're doing, page to you. And I said, oh, it's really interesting. You know? I had sort of this Jungian bent. And so I said, well, whatever inspired you to get those? She goes, well, there's no damn Wi-Fi. So I thought, I might as well read them. And I didn't say anything. You know, why ruin it with another observation?
Yeah.
and so she's been here and there sort of dabbling in these myths. And as you were talking, and this is where it finally came together for me as a father and and some kind of the whole notion of the return to myth itself, the ritual is very often, you know, that here she is at this horrible point in her life where she's very alienated, feels frightened inwardly and alienated from her mother and living, you know, in Rogers Park, Chicago, and far from her friends with no Wi-Fi. But she finds it within her, just very naturally, in an emergent sense, as you mentioned, to dip back into the well, you know, this so-called deep well of collective experience, you know. And I can only believe that if she just allows this to continue to emerge, and if I can stay out of the way, you know, stop and don't be smart, and urge her to read more, you know, as a goal. I think that I mean, I'm just very, really, it just dawned on me that, well, that's why she's doing it. You know, she's responding to something, some very deep need to, again, to return to that point from which we all, and she also as an individual, began, and to affirm it again and begin the trip, you know, downward. To return again and to leap in and again and again and again. And it's just such a marvelous image that you presented and helped me a lot. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I didn't realize that there was this circular stuff going on. I really like I said, when I was preparing for this talk, I was like, what is it? Like, I know I had this feeling, and it really just took me back to, like, jumping off and going in the river, and that's kind of what propelled that. So a couple of things. So, you know, thank you for responding to the suffering of your daughter in that way, you know, and trusting that emergence as it comes. I think it's really interesting when to notice that, like, adolescents, they, like, can go really deep with, like, can go back to stuff that it's like, wow, that's, like, mythic or tribal or, you know, something like that. So that's really interesting to hear, too. And the thing about this, yeah, I think what I liked about this is kind of like this image, but yeah, it's not like you get here and then you end here. That's what I don't like about this.
Well, I mean,
and you got a squirrel.
You have to qualify at the end. Mm-hmm. Make it satisfying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because
say, well, this is just in the realm of relative
temporal. Yeah.
Here and now, you know, but actually, it goes
on. Right, yeah. So, thank you. Yeah, the comments, yeah.
Thank you.
And another thing I wanted, something that I thought of where you were saying that, is this sort of like collective feeling. And I think, I don't know if I said this, but that feeling of that pull, it's like this being part, I'm a part when I feel that of something much, much bigger. And it's not me, but I'm it. You know, that kind of thing, like going back to Dongshan. It's like this feeling that I have of, and when I'm in those sort of, like I was saying, I feel stuck, it helps to connect with that because it feels like it opens up this sense of being a part of something much bigger that I am a really small part of, but it just kind of, like being in a river, it's like being, or in the ocean, just like pushing you forward. It seems frightening maybe, but it's also somehow very reassuring, this sort of, force that, I don't, not to go into Star Wars, but like, you know, like, that's propelling, I don't know, it's like this, like, I'm going to stop talking, but, yeah.
One thing that I
think
your description of vows and what the vows are that kind of brought to me that I've never considered before is that, yes, there's this kind of like contradictory, oxymoronic thing to it, but it's also, and this is the Alex coming up, this is the me coming up. It's also, to me, it seems like a sort of rebellious thing, like a sort of contrarian thing. Like, beings are numberless, I vow to free them.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I had never considered that before, and that's a very, that adds a whole lot to what these are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, what are you rebelling against?
Everything enough.
Yeah. I think sometimes of these vows and bodhisattva activity is kind of a rebellion against the conventional way that I usually think, or that we do things. And the conventional way is usually like, I'm the most important person, very self-centered. When we think about these vows, it's actually very much rebelling against that and totally turning that around. So like everyone else is equal. You know, we respond to them, and it's not just about me.
It's a rebellion against what we take to be like basic logic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Numberless.
Mm-hmm.
Do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing that Jerome brought up and relates to these vows too is that the idea of attainment and
mm-hmm.
And attainment seems to have a future.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get there, then what happens? The practice is just here.
Mm-hmm.
It's just here in this time, in this moment. Again, with the numberless, these contradictory things, we're trying to, we're trying to attain something that is not possible, but we can just be here
mm-hmm.
and practice and be, help
out, help others. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. That's what I was trying to, like, that's what I liked about some of these quotes from Norman Fisher and Shohaku Okamura, like, talking about that. It's like, it's not about attainment. It's about practice, like you said. It's like, about, what did he say?
Practice just means you're here.
Yeah. We have to live right here, right now, with this body and mind. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for your comments. Remind me of, I believe this is something that you actually said in the previous time we talked one time. We were talking about how do you keep practice going during your workday, like in your routine. Mm-hmm. And so you were talking about different ways that you exhibit that, like if you're sitting on the CTA, you're sitting in your seat, or something, and you talked about, you know, when you're walking downtown or wherever that you're going, focusing on your feet, kind of the way that we do in our walking meditation. And when I first heard that, I kind of took that into practice, and it really helps me in those moments. You know, I'll be like, if I'm running late for work, or, you know, I'm in my own head, and you know, I'll take that moment and I'll reconnect and I'll say, oh, my feet are walking and this thing, and suddenly it's this letting go, and it's this feeling like, oh, I'm part of this experience. So like kind of your description about going down the river, which is weird because then I seem to be walking slower than everyone else. But in a way that's also kind of like rebelling. And yeah, here I am kind of focusing on my feet and hopefully not walking with people or, you know, being anyone's way, but getting out of my own way. I too started a new job last summer, and you know, I had certain reasons for doing it. Once I kind of settled in that routine, I had, you know, lots of plans from, like, you know, I want to do this, I want to do this, and, you know, all these things. And I have really, really bad anxiety, so, you know, a lot of times, you know, I'll come home and, you know, I have lots of thoughts, and that makes it hard to let go a lot. And especially, my anxiety involves planning a lot. So, you know, I want to practice the piano, I want to see these friends, I want to read these books and do all these things. And so it's hard for me sometimes to come home and feel comfortable not doing anything and feel like that's okay. And I've slowly started to times. And it's, I find that the more that I am comfortable with that, like very, very just starting to feel comfortable with it, it's so freeing. And it's like, I'm much happier. I just feel, I can't even describe it, but yeah, it's, I think it, your talk kind of resonated a lot with that feeling. So thank you.
Just to wrap that up, what Mike's saying made me feel that your talk, Matt, was in some ways about the physicality of vows, mm-hmm. you know, taking it out of some idea of vows, but just, you know, yeah, as a physical presence. So, thank you very much. Wonderful talk.
Thank you.
Let's close then with reciting the 40-second vows.
Beings are known.